Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, a UW professor is teaching a history course that has some students asking more questions about their parents' time growing up. We'll hear more about the class that has parents talking about their generation coming up.
Now, people at risk of suicide can feel isolated and like there's no one who cares or that they want to bother with their problems. There can be a stigma also against seeking out help for any kind of mental health concern.
When he was a freshman at UW-Madison, Conlon Bass wanted to make a difference, so he founded the Bandana Project. Now a senior ready to graduate, the project will continue under the umbrella of the UW-Madison chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness, or NAMI. Conlon, welcome to Central Time.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
And Kenya, thanks for coming in.
Yeah, thank you.
So Conlon, how did the Bandana Project start?
So my freshman year, I had a friend who goes to University of River Falls tell me that they had a professor whose son had died by suicide. And as a show of support for that professor, they wore white bandanas on their backpacks. And I had already been involved with the National Alliance on Mental Illness at Madison. And I just had the idea that it could be a broader mental health awareness movement. Lime green is a color of that movement, so I figured that would be a good bandana color, very eye-catching. And then UWPD also produces resource cards, so I thought it'd be a great idea if people who had the bandanas could also carry these cards, so kind of a double mental health awareness and suicide prevention movement.
And you've also talked about having been touched by suicide yourself.
Yeah, unfortunately, in high school, my freshman year, my uncle on my mom's side died by suicide. And after that, my family did a variety of like mental health awareness walks, NAMI walks, out of the darkness, that kind of thing. So I got introduced to the world of like anti-mental illness stigma through those. And then unfortunately, just before my senior year of high school, a good friend of mine also died by suicide. So at that point, I was just really looking for a way to kind of change things or look for an outlet to try and improve situations for people struggling with mental illness, just because nobody's unaffected by it.
And Kenya, so the bright green, lime green bandanas are very eye-catching, as Conlon said, and people who have them on their backpacks or wherever have resources. But how do you actually make sure that people know what the bandana means so that they know, oh, that's someone that I could talk to?
So a big thing that we do in our club as the Bandana Project is advocacy. We like to spread the word about the Bandana Project, and we do a lot of distributions on campus, and really we just push for people to spread the word. And we are very approachable, we like to think. A lot of students come up to us and ask us what the bandanas are for, and that's kind of part of the whole point of the project, is to create conversation and ask questions and to understand what the bandanas are for, and then therefore leading into understanding what suicide prevention is.
And so, Kenya, what would you say are the specific goals of the project? Is it raising awareness? Is it reaching people who are specifically at risk of suicide? What are you hoping to accomplish?
I would say it's equally for both things that you asked. I would say the main goal is to overall prevent suicide. And in order to diminish the stigma that's associated with it, it's really important to just spread the word and get people to normalize the subject of talking about suicide. And that's a huge part of the Bandana Project, because students are always talking about, hey, what's the green bandana for? So that's a huge part of ending the stigma with suicide.
And Conlon, it can be very difficult to measure the success of prevention because it's measuring things that don't happen. But how do you measure success, and what does success look like to you?
Right. For me personally, more like anecdotally, I guess, I felt that the program has kind of accomplished what I envisioned at the outset, just in having people come up and say, I was having a rough week last week. I saw a lot of bandanas. It made my week better. Someone saying, I've struggled with mental illness in the past. Knowing that people are out there with these resources means a lot to me, because I didn't know how to access them when I was struggling, stuff like that. So I guess just kind of people saying how it's touched them in their own ways. Again, nobody's unaffected, as I said, but it manifests differently in everybody's lives. So I guess just kind of hearing about the different ways that it's helped people or how they've noticed it, change the campus climate, that kind of thing.
And how many bandanas have been distributed since you started the project, do you know?
Yeah, in total, over 3,500 bandanas.
Wow. And so are they specifically on backpacks? Do people use them in other ways? Is there a recommended way so people can notice them and say, oh, that's another one of those?
Right. Usually we just say tie it however you'll like it on your backpack. Lots of faculty members have little bags or satchels that they'll tie them onto. Anything you carry with you that's just a symbol that you carry the resource cards and you stand in solidarity with the movement works for us.
So it's faculty as well as students?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
We're talking with Conlon Bass and Kenya Link. They are both involved with the Bandana Project, which is a suicide prevention effort that started on the UW-Madison campus when Conlon founded it and is continuing under Kenya's coordination. And Conlon, without breaking any confidentiality, of course, could you share a story or two of someone for whom the Bandana Project was really a lifeline?
Yeah. I've had people come up to me before and say, I didn't know what the bandanas were for until my friend received one and knew that they had the resource cards. And it was at a time where I was struggling. I was looking for an outlet. I was going to make a decision about my life in the coming weeks. And reading through the cards, like learning about the program, kind of influenced me to take that first step, that first leap forward, and just calling a number and seeing what the number had to say on like a suicide prevention hotline. And that was a very touching moment for me because I was someone who was borderline mental health crisis, who kind of saw the green bandana, paused, and was able to get help through their friend.
And Kenya, have you had similar experiences?
Yes, a few similar experiences, almost exactly like Conlon's. A lot of people, it's just the first step in preventing whatever thoughts they're having to harm themselves or if they're struggling in any way, shape, or form.
And Kenya, you are taking over from Conlon here on UW-Madison, but it sounds like the idea of the Bandana Project has spread well past this campus. Where else is it being done, and where are they hoping to do it?
Yeah, so it's at quite a handful of big universities, at Minnesota, at Iowa, a few other Big Ten universities that I can't think of at the top of my head. But there's also like smaller UW schools like River Falls, Stevens Point, and a few other Minnesota schools also. And we also provide a lot of resources to high school students who do reach out to us. Like my high school that I went to, I know that there's a few students there who want to start it there because they've heard of it through me. So
even reaching to younger
populations. Yeah, we try to spread the word to as many populations as we can.
And Conlon, what's it like for you? You started this as a freshman, and here not only is it well-established and successful here, but spreading. Did you ever expect that?
Oh, no. That's probably my favorite part of the program, just how enthusiastic and excited people are about to share it, to spread it where they live, just to show support in any way they can. It's been overwhelming, just the response. I didn't expect, no, when I started it, but it's been really amazing to see.
And Conlon, I also want to offer suggestions to people who are not on a campus for how they can be a resource and support for people at risk of suicide. What would you recommend?
Yeah, I think a great first step in any situation is to just listen without judgment. Listen to what someone's saying. Take it as true for them. Try and refer them to whatever local resources, places for support that they can get, and just kind of re-engage with that person afterwards. Make sure you follow up, help them through their journey, because it's tough to get help.
Well, Conlon, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
And Kenya, thanks so much for sharing your experiences.
Thank you so much.
Conlon Bass founded the Bandana Project at UW-Madison as a freshman. Kenya Link will take over coordinating the project as part of the UW-Madison chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness, or NAMI, with Conlon's graduation this month. The National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 800-273-8255. Veterans Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 800-273-8255, option 1.
Coming up, a history professor is working to close the generation gap by asking students to find out more about the daily lives of their parents growing up. We hear more about the History of Your Parents' Generation course. That's coming up on Central Time.
You're with us on Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a look at why the U.S. lags behind many other countries in recycling and why our guest says that's bad for the environment and for the economy.
Now, I was a history major and even got a master's in it, but if you're not a history lover, a history class can sometimes feel like a chore with lots of memorizations of dates and studying events that can feel distant and disconnected to the world of today.
But one history professor is taking a unique approach to teaching history to help students connect to events of the past by interviewing their parents.
And we want to hear from you, parents. What memories of music, fashion, and history from your generation do you think young people should know about? And even if you don't have kids, what were the cultural milestones for you in the 1970s, maybe 1980s? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and share your thoughts.
Jennifer Ratner-Rosenhagen is the Merle Curdy and Vilas Borghese Distinguished Achievement Professor of History at UW-Madison. She teaches a course called The History of Your Parents' Generation. Jennifer, welcome to Central Time.
And thank you for having me.
Well, talk about the origins of this idea. It sounds like a fun class. What brought you here?
Well, first, Rob, I have to take issue with your description of history as a bunch of boring names and facts and
dates. I love history.
I know. But I don't want our listeners to think that we are boring our students over at UW-Madison. And so in that regard, I would like to think that my exciting, engaging history that brings the past to life is actually very conventional for what my colleagues are doing at UW-Madison. I got to make a shout out for my department and also probably for our satellite campuses as well. So the inspiration for the course, I have to say, came working with students for years here and thinking, you know, what are ways in which I can connect history, you know, whether it's deep, you know, in the past or more recent history, really connect it to my students so they feel the stakes. They recognize that the people who lived in the past are much like them today. I mean, they may have different worldviews and moral commitments, but they were people, you know, shaped by larger forces. And so my original idea for the course was actually to do a history of their generation, so a history of your generation, and it was going to be a more contemporary history. But I, after kind of playing with that idea, I realized how hard it would be for students to toggle between something really autobiographical that might be even personal in a way that might be emotionally hard for them to then widen out and look for larger social factors. So I just did the next thing that seemed logical to me, go a generation earlier. What is the prehistory of their lives? What were the social, political, economic circumstances that shaped who their parents were? And so that the idea was born.
And for a lot of the students you have, say, incoming freshmen, their parents would be in kind of my demographic, people born maybe in the 60s and 70s. And is that the zone, the sweet spot you're
Well, I
must
say, I'm gonna date myself, but I was born in 1970. So there was a kind of, I don't want to say unpleasant aha moment when I realized, oh, my dear Lord, that's me, you know, that we're talking about. The demographics is never perfect. Some parents are considerably older. But yes, the course was conceived, and for the most part, it has paired out that the students who are at UW today, their parents would be born, primarily during the 60s and perhaps in the early 70s. And to be honest, there's enough give in the course that even if, you know, someone was born in 55 or even as late as 76, which is conceivable, you know, the course is catching them somewhere in their young childhood, their adolescence, their early adulthood. And so, you know, it may not be exactly the same for every student, but we are definitely providing that student some snapshot, or extended snapshot, I should say, of their parent at some point, and they're growing to become who they became.
And is part of the goal here for students to use this firsthand eyewitness to history, their parents, and hopefully go and talk to somebody, their parent or someone else from their previous generation?
Well, in fact, that's the first assignment that they have. So what they're asked to do is to interview their parents. They can interview one, they can interview the other, you know, in the event that their parents are no longer living, or they don't have a relationship with their parent, or for whatever reason can't, they're asked to interview someone in their parents' generation. And I provide them a survey asking everything from, like, your first political memory, what were conversations at the child, you know, at the dinner table, you know, when did you recognize what religion you were, that was something distinct as opposed to what other people happened, what major world event was the first one of your memory, you know, what were your favorite movies, your fashion, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then they take that information. I mean, that alone is a treasure trove. Many students are, you know, just blown away at how forthcoming their parents are, telling them things they had no idea about their parents. And then they take that first that first bit of information and they think about generations in history. And then what they do is, so they use some work, some sociological and historical work on what are generations, how can we conceive of generations moving throughout history, and they use it to kind of interpret their own parents through that lens. They put it to the side, and we spend however many weeks, the bulk of the course, doing real high-octane social, political, intellectual history of the period, and then they go back at the end of the course, now, as historians, really understanding this period, and they re-interview their parents in a much more informed way. And I have to say the first surveys are a blast. You know, it's just kind of a mishmash of what the students are learning. The end interviews that are then turned into papers are some of the most powerful things that I have read as a professor, because those students are now informed. They can ask very pointed questions about their parents. And again, it's been really impressive to me how open some of these parents have been about telling their kids sometimes hard things that they otherwise, you know, wouldn't want to share with them.
Talking to Jennifer Ratner-Rosenhagen, history professor at UW-Madison, teacher of a course called The History of Your Parents' Generation. I know you can't probably share specific details, but can you give us a sense of the kinds of stories you've gotten back from students and their parents and how they fit into history, maybe in ways that your students didn't expect?
Oh, boy. I want to say each in their own way, every one of these students yields something that for me also, well, first of all, it can be very moving, you know, because I had a case, I've now taught this class many, many times. I think the first or second time I taught it, a student who hadn't talked to his dad in 10 years.
Wow.
And didn't want to interview him initially because he harbored a lot of upset and resentment. But as the course went on, and again, we're not doing group therapy at all, but just the history gave him some perspective. And I don't even know what it was, but it made him feel that he could forgive whatever it is he needed to forgive. And there was a rapprochement, and he interviewed his dad for the, you know, for that end interview and then a paper. One story I like to tell is someone found out that he had a half sibling that his parents told him about.
Okay.
But the parents thought this was maybe an occasion to unveil that. I'll give you an example of one that sticks with me, and that is, and this was several years ago, was teaching a course, and we got to the early 80s and the early AIDS epidemic, you know, Rock Hudson and the first news about AIDS coming out precisely at the moment, you know, when gay liberation is finally, you know, really making its entrance on American stage. And then you have this horrible epidemic. And one of my students said to me, you know what, while we were reading this material, I think my mom might have actually been a nurse in Boston. I don't know, somewhere. She went back and interviewed her mom. Her mom was at the front lines in Boston at one of the gay clinics that was, you know, right at the nerve center of these killing fields, you know, where so many. And so she was able to find out, you know, she only had this vague recollection that her mom, you know, something about a nurse, maybe something about AIDS, but the class helped crystallize, boom. And she went in and she was able to find out, and the stories her mother had, you know, that she wasn't hiding them from her daughter, but there was no occasion to have that conversation.
I want to ask a kind of a conceptual thing for how students come out of this, because I read a lot of history, and I have a trouble. There's a distinction. There's now, right? There's the present, and there's history, and that's something different. And trying to grasp the idea that people then were living through now, and people now are living through history.
Yeah.
I'm rambling, inanely here, but is that something that students are coming out of this class
with? To be honest, you just said it. That's one of the most profound things that they can get out of the course. I mean, there is this sort of binocular vision, if you will, between, they're just moving back and forth between here, now, their parents now as they are, and now, then as they imagined. I mean, one, and realizing they're part of the history because they're their parents' offspring. You know, they were raised by these people. And so I do think the class has this, I mean, I don't know if binocular vision or stereo sound, there's a dimensionality to the class that I think is very, very, very powerful. I mean, I think one of the things the class tries to do is for them to see their parents in two ways. One, as they became who they were, in part, not exclusively, because of the context in which they lived. The politics mattered, you know, the stagflation mattered, you know, religious contestation mattered. I mean, not in everyone's case in everyone's time, mm-hmm. but, you know, what you would learn about the 70s and 80s, those movements, those circumstances, those events made their parents who they were. But if I'm, but to, on the flip side, that their parents were also historical subjects. They were shaping that history. They were acting back on that history. They were the ones wearing the bell bottoms or going to the marches or listening to Bruce Springsteen and changing their major, you know, to be a labor studies historian or, you know, something like that.
Briefly, just in our last few moments, is this for those maybe more a history averse people, is this maybe a gateway drug for those students to say, wow, this is more interesting than I maybe thought it was before I came in?
I love that you use that phrase, gateway drug, because I think about things that are gateway drug to the intellectual life. And I think about books for me that were those gateway drugs. Yay, Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, for example. I mean, that's what we all, I think, hope for. And I think this class is pretty good at accomplishing that, making history not feel remote, not feel distant, feel relevant to their life, and maybe get them to want to read more, do more, take another class.
Jennifer, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was UW-Madison history professor Jennifer Ratner-Rosenhagen. She's teaching a course we've been talking about called The History of Your Parents' Generation. Well, with a little thematic music into the news, I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, a philosopher looked at biology, astronomy, geology, and more to see what it took for any of us to be here. Turns out a lot had to fall into place to make you.
First, you might not think much about the things you recycle after you drag them to the curb or haul them to a local collection point.
But it turns out that recycling is not only important for the environment, it's a $105 billion industry that employs 500,000 people in the U.S. And many manufacturers rely on access to recycled materials to produce high-quality and affordable goods.
Our next guest says the U.S. lags behind many other countries, though, in our recycling rates, and the industry as a whole is in trouble. Beth Porter is Green America's Climate and Recycling Director. Beth creates content and resources to help people waste less stuff and improve their recycling habits. Her new book is Reduce, Reuse, Reimagine, Sorting Out the Recycling System. Beth, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, how do we compare to other developed countries, Beth, when it comes to recycling in the United States?
So recycling in the United States is really at a crossroads right now. We've invested a lot in the last few decades to get enthusiasm up, which I would say was very successful. People love to recycle. They love to talk about how much they recycle. But unfortunately, that hasn't been reflected in our overall recycling rate. And I think a lot of that is from confusion, from not understanding our recycling rules of what can and can't be recycled. I think a lot of folks have the question of why? Why are we recycling? Where does it go? So I wanted to try and clear up that confusion to help us increase our recycling rates to what other developed nations are seeing, like, you know, Germany, even Taiwan are at 60% recycling rates, whereas we're hovering at 34%, where we've been stuck for about the last 20 years.
Let's tackle those questions you just brought up. Why do we want to recycle?
Recycling has high environmental benefits and also benefits to communities. So a lot of folks think that we need to recycle to reduce landfill space, which is absolutely true. But we really also need to close that loop. We need to have recycled materials that reduce our need to do mining and deforestation activities and other extraction methods that results in lower greenhouse gas emissions that are climate change causing emissions, and reducing our overall impact and pressure on the natural resources we have. So we want to be able to have recovered materials rather than needing to extract new materials, which is so much more intensive of a process. And it's also better for communities. More recycling means less incineration and landfilling, which has been burdened disproportionately by certain communities, largely communities of color, lower income communities. So recycling has been another process to urge and push forward as a solution so that we don't have to rely so much on these more linear disposal methods that don't have as much benefit for the environment and can negatively impact communities.
And as far as where it goes and what is done with it, I want to get into, you talk about two different ideas of recycling. One where we separate out everything into separate bins, and then the other one, I think it's called single stream, where we just put all recyclables in one place. That has its advantages. We don't have a lot of bins and a lot of sorting, but it causes certain problems with the stuff we're hoping to recycle. What happens?
Absolutely. So single stream has become the most common recycling method for our curbside recycling programs. And exactly as you said, it's all in one bin. It requires no sorting on the part of the resident. And that has resulted in more participation because folks, it's easier for folks to participate, which is great. But it's also resulted in high contamination. So we have issues with folks putting in things that are coated in food or beverage. So that's sort of like a cleanliness issue of our recyclables. But when you've got, you know, an orange juice container with a little bit of liquid left and you put it in with your magazines, that single stream all-in-one bin can lead for that orange juice to get to your magazine and saturate it and degrade the quality and marketability of that fiber. So single stream has resulted in the increase in contamination and the lower quality recyclables that are having a really tough time in the market right now.
Talking to Beth Porter from Green America, her new book is called Reduce, Reuse, Reimagine, Sorting Out the Recycling System. A lot of your suggestions for our recycling system, Beth, take place way before we have that item hovering over the bin and trying to figure out if I should put it in or not. And I want to go back there and that it's the three-part thing, the reduce, reuse, recycle. Let's talk about the reduce part where we just use less stuff in the first place.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think we really missed out on helping people understand. You know, we wanted to spread reduce, reuse, recycle everywhere, but it's actually a hierarchy. And so we should all be looking for ways to reduce our waste first. And of course, then reuse what we already have creatively, repair those items. And the actual last resort is recycling responsibly. So focusing on the reduce aspect is something we should be trying to do in our homes, but also what I urge producing companies, retailers to do is look for ways that they can reduce their waste as well, which is really a very important key here because recycling, for all of its wonderful benefits and real measurable benefits, it doesn't erase the fact that we have a product that was produced and made that we've used, and that impact is still there. You know, recycling doesn't negate that. So focusing on the reduce and reuse, that's why those come first.
I've seen arguments that at the point of manufacturing, we should be thinking about recycling so that, and I've heard things like appliances or furniture, even buildings, building things, creating these things in a way that when their life is over, it's easier to sort out the components and recycle them or reuse
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. What I think is a big challenge in our recycling system right now is the lack of communication in some cases between producers and recyclers. So you've got producers making products or different goods that aren't always designed for recyclability, or even if they are designed for recyclability some places, it might not work for the vast majority of the United States recycling program. So it's about creating products that not only have recycled content in them so that we're closing that loop, but that are also able to be responsibly recycled in communities across the U.S. And that's something that I think producers can be, should be doing a lot more of.
And you also offer a lot of concrete suggestions for people who use stuff, all of us, in that reduce a waste side. What kind of things do you recommend people think about to prevent, to find the stuff they're throwing away or recycling and maybe just opt out of it?
Absolutely. Yeah, there's a chapter in the book on the psychology of consumption and recycling, and I think we can do a lot to change our mental habits about how we consume resources and goods, because sometimes it's very automatic. You know, there's not a pause in that, when we're being handed a receipt or a plastic straw, for example, or something like that. So creating more of those sort of disruptions in our daily habits is a really powerful, important step to be able to see what we're using. A good first step is actually looking in our garbage can and our recycling bin, see what we're actually throwing out, and starting from there and think, okay, well, what's something that I could try and find a zero waste option for, or something that I could use to take my own jars and containers to the grocery store? Maybe I don't need that plastic bag for my broccoli and I can take my own reusable produce bag. So a lot of little kind of small 1 degree shifts that we can do in our daily lives, and just looking for those opportunities is the first step, starting to be aware of what we're consuming and the waste that we have. I think that we can often get very overwhelmed, at least I do, and I think many other people do too, about the amount of waste and consumption that we have right now, particularly in this country. But it's important to look and see what's within our control. You know, what are we throwing out in our house, and start from there with a tangible plan to try and reduce those items straight at our home.
A lot of the suggestions you make involve kind of mindset shifts, which seems hard to pull off, but you actually give a little history of recycling from the 20s through the 50s, where we went from, scrap metal and waste people, that's kind of un-American, buy new stuff. Then World War II, where recycling was this most patriotic thing imaginable. And then back to the 50s when we were, flinging our plastic plates out into the lawn, basically. We can turn on a dime here, it seems like.
Yeah, we definitely have a history of shifting back and forth. And I think, with the war effort, it was really a fascinating time because you saw the scrap drives, you saw the victory gardens, and people really looking for ways to reduce waste. But we're talking about a long term here. That was a certain time period. There was an end date once the war was done. There's kind of, the prosperity around the corner, that hopefulness was there. But what I hope that we can do now is a fundamental transformation, really, with how we use resources and how we discard them. And I think this year we've seen a huge amount of awareness that's been raised through the concerns with ocean plastic pollution and, of course, the straw phenomenon, which has surprised many environmentalists, including myself, of the popularity of how fast that movement grew. But that's an opportunity. That's a door to open and discuss how we're using waste in other ways and try and achieve that spillover behavior where we think, okay, well, now people are really thinking about the straws. We also want people to think about the cups that's coming in or the paper bag they're using, and seeing that larger chain from the decisions we make and the decisions that producers make in making these items, and how that all leads back to the environment and impacted communities.
Beth Porter is Green America's Climate and Recycling Director. Her new book is Reduce, Reuse, Reimagine, Sorting Out the Recycling System.
And we want to hear from you. Are you committed to recycling? Do you try to reduce the amount of things you consume or reuse what you can? What systems are in place where you live? And do you think they support or discourage recycling by residents? And if you work in a business that relies on access to recycled goods, tell us about it by tweeting us at CentralTimeWPR.
We'll pick up that conversation coming up on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we pick up our conversation with Beth Porter. She's Green America's Climate and Recycling Director. Her new book is Reduce, Reuse, Reimagine, Sorting Out the Recycling System.
And we want to hear from you. How easy is it to recycle where you live? What would make it easier? If you have a single bin recycling system now, would you be willing to separate materials yourself to make it more likely that contamination won't ruin some of the items? How important is it to you to buy items that contain recycled materials? And if you try to do that, is it hard to find them? Tweet us at CentralTimeWPR and let us know.
We'll go to your calls now. Kenneth is with us in Janesville. Kenneth, hi.
Hello. Since the 1st of January, China has refused to buy any reused newspaper. And where is all this these millions of tons of used newspaper been going since then.
Kenneth, thanks. Tell us about the China connection and all this, Beth.
Yeah, that's a great question. Thank you, Kenneth. So just a bit of backstory that in the past, for the past few decades, we've been exporting about one third of our recyclables. Half of that has been going to China. And yet, exactly as Kenneth said, this year, China has put forth a policy that bans our recycled materials and has put forth a very strict contamination rate of 0.5%. Previously, the bales we were sending may have had 5% contamination. So it's a pretty big turnaround. But now what we're seeing is really throughout the industry, folks are trying to find new end buyers in those new end markets. And some of those have been overseas and other parts of Asia. And also looking back towards domestic companies. And that's what they're striving for right now, is to find new end buyers that can fill the hole that this China disruption has caused. And there's a lot of tension. There's a lot of pain in the industry right now, to be perfectly honest, of trying to navigate this huge disruption. But there's also a lot of optimism. People are very hopeful and optimistic that this is going to be a huge transformation for our recycling system. And instead of relying on China to be buying our flawed items, there's a lot more emphasis going into education and cleaning up the supply of recyclables so that they're more appealing and will be purchased by domestic companies. And so that's where we're seeing, you know, the effects of China right now. And of course, it's still happening. There's still a lot of transition that's going on. Some communities are actually moving from single stream back to dual stream or multi-stream, where we see lower contamination rates there. But right now, that's the goal, is to find new end buyers for this material. So that's unfortunately where we're at. Kenneth, fortunately and unfortunately, I guess I could say.
Kenneth, thanks for the call. Going out to Lydia in Richmond, Illinois. Lydia, hi.
Hi. My question is about, my service does only offer, you know, all your recyclables in one bin. And I just wanted to know if you had any advice as to what I could do to make those recyclables more useful, or if there's another avenue I should take outside of that service to make sure my recyclables are being put into the right places.
That's a great question. Yeah, we're saying clean, empty, and dry. You know, these are the things we should be striving for with our recyclables. So we don't have to clean our recyclables perfectly. They don't need to look brand new, but they shouldn't be dripping with food or beverage. That's a big one. And another huge piece is just knowing what is your local recycling rules and what your local facility accepts and doesn't accept, and sticking with those rules. And if you have a question about that, a great resource is Earth 911. You can go and enter in any item that you're trying to recycle in your zip code, and they'll advise for the best steps for how you can recycle it. Because sometimes an item might not be recyclable in your single stream curbside program, but there might be a drop-off location near you where you can take that item, so you can still make sure it's getting in the recycling stream. And making sure that things are emptied out and not contaminated with food is a big one. That's really huge. So if you make sure to do that, that's actually a big difference and very helpful in ensuring that contamination is down, the quality of your recyclables up, and that makes them more marketable.
Lydia, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Beth Porter. Her new book is Reduce, Reuse, Reimagine. Back to your calls now. Mark is on the line in Bloomer. Mark, hello.
Hey there, friend. My wife and I, due to my job, have been moving all over the state of Wisconsin, primarily northeast Wisconsin and northwest Wisconsin, and we've chosen to live mostly rural. And we're willing to drive our recycling into the local recycling center, but I know the majority of my rural neighbors, they will not. You can put your trash to the curb, but you cannot put your recycling to the curb, and you know where they're going to put their recycling. They're not driving it into town.
Mark, thanks a lot for the call. And in a lot of rural places around the country, Beth, I imagine there's not that curbside pickup. Mm-hmm. Are there community efforts to say, okay, we'll get everybody in this square mile or so together and try to work together to cart the stuff over?
Yeah, absolutely. This is a great point. And I mean, throughout recycling's history, we've seen community come together and fill that need where there weren't recycling pickup options. And sometimes it was a great example is Recycle Here, I believe in Detroit. And they just put out a sign and said, Recycle Here. And once a month, people brought their recyclables and a few community members were willing to truck the recyclables in. And it really helped for the community members to have that centralized space. I believe also this was shared in schools. So kids go home and say, we have to recycle, and and got the parents to make sure they were dropping off their recyclables at this kind of informal drop-off station, really. So there are those kinds of grassroots efforts that I think are great and really inspiring that people do. I guess I would also ask of your neighbors, you know, what's the barrier for them? Is it just that there's not a curbside service? And is there some sort of like community effort that can show the demand for a curbside service? This doesn't have to be a community-run initiative that operates in perpetuity, of course, unless someone wants to do that. But just to show that there's a demand out there for recycling in this part of your county, that can be a huge indicator to a local government that they need to expand their recycling services because they're going to be getting materials from it and that folks want it to be there. So there are different ways to express demand. We need to express demand, of course, in the purchases we make to try and buy recycled content items, but we can also express demand for better recycling services, more transparency from our local government. Town hall meetings are a great way to do that. Going and expressing that you need expanded service. Not everyone has access to this. We want recycling to be accessible for everyone. And if the barriers are logistical, keeping someone from participating rather than ideological, that's a great question to ask and start from there to see how much interest there is in your community in recycling if that opportunity were there.
Thanks for calling in and sharing your story. Gary is with us now in Decorah, Iowa. Gary, hi. What did you want to bring up?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. This has been great too, by the way, but most of this has been front-end oriented is how I would word it, and I'm kind of wondering, are there new technologies coming down the pike as far as the processing of our recyclables to make that maybe not necessarily energy efficient, but more profitable, lower those costs, and make it more usable for most people? So I'll hang up, and thanks again for this.
High-tech sorting of our recyclables, Beth.
That is a wonderful question. That's definitely one of the solutions that folks in the industry are striving for right now is more increased efficient sorting machinery. So there are companies that provide the machines that sort a lot of our recyclables, particularly in these single stream programs. The end result is a MRF. That's a material recovery facility. And those buildings hold giant sophisticated machines that are able to separate out our paper fibers from our plastics and then each kinds of plastic and using giant magnets for metals. I mean, they're really cool, honestly. If you live near a MRF, I highly recommend anyone go and take a tour of these facilities because they're fascinating. But there's constantly research and striving for innovation to make these machines improved in efficiency and also the sophistication of them to make sure that they're able to catch all of the very different materials we're seeing entering the stream, all the different plastics and things of that nature. Now, the one challenge is that this requires investments, obviously. So the MRF needs to be able to improve their machines and adapt to this, you know, kind of cutting edge technology to make sure that their sorting capabilities are matching that. So I think we're going to be seeing, hopefully, more and more investment in recycling infrastructure to make sure that we're able to sort and process these materials efficiently and effectively.
Thanks for that call. And Beth, we'll leave it there for now. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me on the show. This is great. I loved having all the questions. And folks can reach out at bethrecycles.com if they have more questions. I love to talk about this stuff.
Wonderful.
So thank you.
Thanks so much. And thanks for all your calls. Beth Porter is Green America's Climate and Recycling Director. We've been talking about her new book. It's called Reduce, Reuse, Reimagine, Sorting Out the Recycling System.
And you can keep the conversation going over on Twitter. How seriously do you take recycling? Have you found easy ways to make sure that everyone in your household knows what can be recycled and what can't? How easy or hard is it to recycle where you live? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know. When you see an image of a unicorn, it's usually cute and colorful, often prancing somewhere near a rainbow.
But it turns out that the prehistoric version might have been, well, terrifying.
Well, we have 5 species of rhinoceroses in the world today. There were as many as 25 different kinds a few hundred thousand years ago. And one of them, the Elasmotherium sibiricum, or Siberian unicorn, was a monster.
Now, this Siberian unicorn tipped the scales at around 3.5 tons. That's about 7,000 pounds. You might think of that as making it slow, but it turns out it had pretty slim legs, so the scientists think it was, might have been a pretty fast runner.
Its body was covered in shaggy hair, and the horn coming out of its skull was the largest of any known species of rhino, current or extinct.
And now researchers used to think that the Siberian rhino was extinct before humans came on the scene. Looks like there might have been some overlap, though, about 39,000 years ago, when extinct around the same time as other animals called megafauna around the world.
And scientists don't think that our species had anything to do with their extinction, which isn't surprising considering how massive it was. It was an herbivore, but Rob, can you imagine coming across something like that?
A, no. B, calling this a unicorn. I mean, it's a kind of rhinoceros. You think unicorn, it's what, a horse with a horn?
Yeah.
I challenge the scientists' use of unicorn in this one instance.
Well, we'll have to agree to disagree and hope they're not still around somewhere.
I can't agree to that.
This is Central Time.